K2 Romeo India Whiskey, along with Mel, K2 KEY. The two of us gather the clan each Sunday night, and we hold a thing called the Technical Med. By now, most people know the main purpose of the Technical Med is to transfer information back and forth about this complicated hobby of ham radio and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. We try to discuss those. Almost any kind of a subject that is of interest to ham radio operators is appropriate for the Technical Med. A person signs into the Technical Med by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. Do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW. KB2MAR, Gabe, yes.
November 2 X-ray, Juliet, November, yes.
KC2, SYL, Bill, yes.
Okay, so for UA2, Victor, David, Henry, John, yes. So far we have Gabe, Wesley, Bill, and John, in that order. Anyone else?
Good evening, all. KC2KEY.
Ernie.
KC2MDP, no questions.
Okay, we heard MDP, MDV with no questions. Who was the person who signed in after John but before MDV?
KC2KEY.
Nick, name is Bernie, yes.
Okay, we heard Mel and Bernie. Bernie, when you give me your call letters, please.
Whiskey Oscar, 2 November, WO2N.
Okay, WO2N, Bernie. All right, let's start off with Gabe first. KB2MAR, go right ahead, Gabe. K2RIW.
K2RIW, KB2MAR. I was asking a question last week regarding the transformer situation. I don't think you forgot about that one. The thing here is that the unit runs between 221 and 230 volts. Now, I have a voltage converter for 240. I was wondering, step up from 120 to 240, and the unit was designed for between 221 and 230. Well, that's 10 volts. Well, that 10 to 18 volts higher cause any damage to the internal circuitry or the charger? KB2MAR back to that.
There's no absolute guarantee of that one, Gabe, but as I see, Gabe, I doubt it. Look at it as a percentage point of view. Most modern-day chunks of electronics have got a voltage regulator inside after the power supply. It's either an electronic smoothing circuit or a voltage regulator. And as long as that circuit is not being starved out, as long as you give it the minimum voltage, a little bit more than that, probably is not going to create a problem. No guarantee, but I would give it a try. And you can also try it for short periods of time and see if anything overheats and things like this. Other than that, I don't know of any other way of guaranteeing your performance. If you had the original data sheet for the electronics from the manufacturer, they may tell you what is the required voltage with a plus and minus tolerance. They may tell you plus or minus 10% is okay, or they might tell you anything from 200 to 240 is good enough. You probably don't have that paperwork, although where you know the model number, I wonder if there's a way you could find it by way of the internet as to what was the original manufacturer's specification and requirements. Back to you, Gabe, and drag your feet a little bit in case someone else has a suggestion for this 230 volt requirement when now you're living in the 120 volt world. KB2MAR with a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, seems to be charging correctly. I'm just worried because, when they request 221 to little bit. Well, it's like, what, a 3 to 5% over the requirement. I don't think it's going to cause any damage. I mean, think about it. It's nothing major. But just curious. I don't want to cause any damage to the thing. But the question is a very simple one I have tonight. And unit works fine. When, you know, when I just want to make sure that I'm not causing any long-term damage. Maybe 2 MAR back to that.
Yeah, repeat once again. 221 to 230 is what the manufacturer recommends. Your particular transformer, I think you said, puts out 240. Is that true? Dave, go ahead.
QSL.
That's the 10 volts, so to speak, above the maximum out of 230. That sounds like it's, like you said, only a couple of percent increase. I doubt it. On top of that, you're putting 60 cycles into a transformer that was designed for 50 cycles. Most transformers, when you give it a higher frequency, will run colder, will run cooler. Conversely, if you had a 60 cycle transformer in its design and you fed it 50 hertz because you just brought it over to the United Kingdom, that could create quite a bit of grief. The way a transformer operates, a lower frequency will saturate it faster at a lower voltage, is what I mean. So, higher frequency, slightly higher voltage, I don't think it's going to be a problem. How valuable is the thing? I think it's a tape recorder, as I remember. And I guess the worst that would happen is that if the voltage regulator, which is going to run a little bit warmer because it's dropping a greater amount of voltage, if it overheated, what I've done in the past on a couple of pieces of electronics that I own is I realized that the manufacturer was kind of marginal in what he did to heat sink, the thing that was generating the most amount of heat, the voltage regulator chip. So I added my own little heat sink to it, increased the amount of area or the amount of conduction between it and something else that can dissipate the heat. So if you've got the package open, you can find out if anything is bad by whether or not something's going to get hot. The voltage regulator is the first thing I'd worry about. Giving it a sufficient heat sink, if it doesn't already have one, would be one way you could give it greater protection. I wonder if you've ever seen the inside of the circuit, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2RIW.
Haven't opened it up lately, but I'm going to open it up and check it out. If there's no heat sink, I think it should have one. I mean, voltage regulator always, sometimes I see them just mounted against the circuit board and the regulator uses the circuit board as the heat sink itself. I don't know if that's enough surface area or is the proper material to be used to dissipate that heat, but preferably you want an aluminum one with fins on it, so it's probably the better way to go. But getting back to this 50-60 hertz situation, if it's running on 60 hertz, that means that the transformer is, the inductive reactance is lower, so that means there's more current going into the secondary. Now, the basic P equals I times E overall will be higher, obviously, with the 60 hertz compared to the 50 hertz, and that might create an additional problem in addition to the higher voltage. You obviously have more current with the 60 hertz. KB2MAR by 10.
And 2EO, Dick.
Rich recognized. Gabe, you've got it backwards. It's obvious that if you put DC voltage into the primary of a transformer, if, for instance, your primary winding had, I'm going to pick a number here, 10 ohms of resistance, and you put 120 volts on it, you're going to get a fierce amount of current, a fierce amount of dissipation, because there is no reactance. So as you go lower and lower in frequency, and the extreme is DC, and therefore the transformer would saturate immediately, there would be no real coupling between primary and secondary, and everything would get kind of hot. As you go higher and higher in frequency, the same number of turns on the primary winding develops a greater and greater amount of inductive reactance. Your primary has some number of Henrys of inductance. And since inductive reactance is 2 pi FL, F is one of the frequencies, it's the frequency, the higher the frequency, the same amount of Henrys has a higher amount of inductive reactance. In an ideal transformer, the inductive reactance of the primary and secondary is so high that the only real loading on the input circuit is the coupling between primary and secondary. The secondary load is the only loading on the primary. That's an ideal transformer. Every real transformer has got two loads on the primary. One, the basic current that flows through the primary when there's no load on the secondary at all, because the primary has a finite amount of inductive reactance. Just to give you an example, if I had the right number of Henrys in the primary so that at your operating frequency it had 230 ohms of inductive reactance, and you put 230 volts across that primary, voltage divided by reactance, 230 volts divided by 230 ohms of inductive reactance, would be 1. There would be 1 ampere of current flowing through the primary winding with no loading on the secondary. In the example I'm giving, 230 ohms of basic inductive reactance of the primary. If the wire had a low enough resistance to it, the 1 ampere of current flow could represent very little I squared R heating, and as long as the primary winding and the iron is made in such a way that it doesn't saturate, that inductive reactance will draw 1 ampere, but with a 90 degree phase shift in an ideal transformer. Therefore, you've got lots of volt amperes reactive, but no real power dissipation. If I go to a lower frequency, that same amount of inductance of the primary will be a smaller inductive reactance. Therefore, that basic current flowing to the primary with no loading on the secondary would be greater. On top of that, the lower frequency has a higher probability of saturating the winding. Explaining that one's a little bit more difficult. But if the winding did partially saturate on the peaks of the voltage, because you're operating at a lower frequency than the transformer was designed for, the actual equivalent reactance, equivalent inductance would be a smaller number, the current flow would be greater, and it would be a nonlinear current flow. So,
reflector 9126, link clear.
So as you can tell, lower frequency will make a transformer run with more heat. Higher frequency in general will not. There's a slight exception to what I said, and that is if instead of operating it on 50 hertz, you operate it on 1,000 hertz, depending on the thickness of the laminations, the EI laminations of the wind of the core, the way you make up the magnetic core, that could give you some increased eddy currents at a much higher frequency. But in general, transformers at a higher frequency are happier. Let's see what Rich has got to say about all this. I wonder if you've run into...
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912.
Channel 6.
I wonder if you've run into the problem, Rich, of wrong voltage, wrong frequency for a European versus American piece of electronics. N2EO. Wait for the beep. I should. K2RIW.
Okay, Vic. N2EO. Yeah. Haven't run into the problem with frequency variation. Everything I've got runs on 60 cycles. But a lot of the Collins equipment was built to run on 105 to 115 volts before they raised the voltage a number of years ago. I quote Con Edison once, the target value they shoot for here is 122.8. That's what they shoot for. And what I've done, like on an R390, was I made my own buck boost transformer out of a filament transformer. You've got two choices. You can go to an electrical supply house and get what they call a buck boost, to allow them to buck and lower the voltage or boost and raise it, depending how he sets it. Well, what I've done is you can make your own buck boost out of a filament transformer. In his case, he needs one with a 220-volt primary, and he wants to lower the voltage, what about 10 volts, so he could use an 8.2 or 12-volt filament transformer with a secondary wire to the primary as an auto transformer and lower the voltage.
Okay, you're onto something there, Rich. The transformer he's now got, I'm guessing, takes 115, 120 in and puts out 240. And he's worried that it's out of the range of the 221 to 230 that the unit recommends. So he's around 10 volts high. If he had a 12-volt filament transformer that's made for 120 volts input, he could have two transformers wired on 120. One of them's a filament transformer, and one of them's a current step-up transformer he's using that's stepping the 120 up to 240. Then the 12.6 volts coming out of his filament transformer, he can wire it with the proper phase in series with the 240 coming out of his step-up transformer, and the 240 will be subtracted by 12. He'll be down to 228, so to speak, 227.4. So, if you want to be super safe, by way of a filament transformer, where the secondary winding is in series with your step-up winding, and just select the phase correctly so that the voltage comes out lower. When in doubt, wire it one way or the other, and, you know, whether it's in phase, left to right, or right to left, so to speak, on that filament winding, by putting your voltmeter across the whole operation before it goes into your tape recorder circuitry, you can find out if the voltage is being added or subtracted, and therefore either reverse the primary or the secondary winding of the filament transformer, and you'll get the opposite effect. So, because the filament transformer is probably made for many amperes, you could use the smallest possible filament transformer to do this operation. So, that's another way to go. That's the easiest way to get a step down in voltage. The other way people have done it is with a... let me drop for a second. The only other way people have done it is to drop with a resistor. Well, a resistor dropping network is lossy. You got to worry about its heat dissipation. And it gives you much lower regulation. In other words, if there were various modes of operation of your tape recorder, like, for instance, rewind might draw one amount of current, play or record is another amount of current, whether or not the voltage is, whether or not the volume is set high or low will change the amount of current. Therefore, you get different amounts of voltage drop across the resistor. So a resistor voltage drop, without putting some kind of a fancy electronic circuit across it, is a kind of a sloppy way to go. The filament transformer is a nicer way to go. And getting back to the previous discussion of yours, Gabe, if I'm using a voltage regulator device, and I'm dissipating a whole lot of watts of power. Yes, you'd like to have a great big, thick aluminum heat sink with great big fins and air blowing over it. In your particular case, the total voltage drop, total power dissipated by your regulator is probably something so small that the manufacturer thought he could get away with it with no real heat sink. When you take the tab on a voltage regulator device that's made to go to the heatsink and simply connect it, and worry about whether or not it's hot with voltage, but simply connecting it to the copper foil of a printed circuit board, as chintzy as that looks as a heatsink, that could be dissipating two or three times as much heat safely as the bare bone voltage regulator connected to nothing. So don't shortchange the copper foil on a printed circuit board. Within reason, that's a pretty darn nice heat sink under certain conditions. Over to you, Gabe. KB2MAR, with a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
That sounds also going to my mind, too, to use dropping resistors in each leg of the output of 220. Sounds very tempting to do, because I think the unit uses about 14 watts at maximum using all the features on the unit. But the charger maybe uses like maybe 5-6 watts, something like that. Maybe not around there. And that's all I'm basically going to use it for, is to charge the unit and then run it on battery. So I could probably go that route, put a series resistor in each leg of the 220 output to make it really neat, open up the box of the 220 converter. By the way, it's in the metal cabinet with, like, you know, screws, that type. And just put the resistors across the outputs of the 220. And that should, and maybe put like a, and also I could probably put a double pull, double throw switch to switch that feature in and out when I don't need it. Say I want to use something at higher wattage, I switch the resistor network out of it. Keep it tuning on back to that. Thank you, KEY.
I'm Mel recognized. Okay. Looks like we're back in operation here. Dropping resistor. You're thinking of putting a dropping resistor on each individual leg of the 240 volt output of the transformer. There's nothing magic about combining those into one single resistor and putting it on only one leg, because nothing is center tapped, and your transformer primary on your tape recorder doesn't really care about the symmetry. In fact, when it comes to transformers that are running on 120 volts domestically, really one leg of the 120 volts is essentially ground, and the other leg is hot and one leg is cold. It's the ultimate of unbalance. And I think the United Kingdom's wiring works in a similar way. So you don't have to put a dropping resistor on each individual leg. If you're going to put 10 ohms on each leg, one single resistor of 20 ohms on one leg would do it, for instance. So life would be a little bit more simple that way. And by having it all grouped together in one resistor, you could buy one with a big enough wattage to it that it can easily handle the voltage drop. It can easily handle the voltage drop without overheating. Let's see what Mel's going to say about all this. K2KEY, how would you solve the problem? K2RYW.
Pumpers around, I've used them. They have very small variacs available for either 110 volts or 220 line. These were used for, I think, some instrument applications. If I remember, I had one that actually mounts really into a panel. It's about 2 inches in diameter, and it was meant to stabilize the 110 line. If you're a little low, a little higher, you know, and they have the same ones available for 220. I don't remember what instruments they used them in, Dick, but I remember that they were around. I think I have a couple of them around. I know I used one time. It's the easiest way to go. You can find one with 220. You could easily adjust the line. And like I say, they're pretty small. I was amazed that they wound such small variacs, Dick, over.
Dick at 2EO.
Yeah, Rich recognized. There's nothing magic about using a variac rated for 220. Domestically, getting one rated for 120 is a lot easier than a 240. And he's going to be putting the variac between his Con Ed power and the primary of his step-up transformer. So adjusting the 120 down to, let's say, 105 would be the nice way to go. Rich, N2EO, go ahead with your comment. And I noticed that each time we drop, you'll hear four tones, and then the tones stop. So if we wait for the four tones, then wait for the machine to reset the beep, we'll not be timing it out, I believe. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, what Mel said reminded me, I have one of those, it's a 3 or a 4 amp, 110 volt variac. I have it mounted to the rear panel of my AL1500 amplifier. I use it to regulate the voltage to get it exactly on target with the 6-volt filament on the 8877. And that variac is only about $25 to $30. It's available. You can go online to surplus sales in Nebraska. They got them there. It's a 3 or 4 amp, 120 volt nominal variac input. And what I did, I'm running it on a 240 line, and I put it between the neutral and one leg, and that goes to the primary of my filament transformer, so I can set the filaments on the 8877s right on the head. But when Mel brought that up, that's why I got it. Surplus sales in Nebraska. It was maybe 25 to 30 bucks. It was brand new old stock.
Comment.
Okay, Wesley's got a comment. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay. November to X-ray, Juliet, November. Whatever you say, guys, the last time that we spoke, we also spoke about different options that we may have, two transformers, separating transformers, 100 volt by 100 volts connected together in series, observing the phase, and 220 whatsoever. There is one factor that we didn't pick up, and the factor is the price. If you want to pick up the transformers or auto transformers, connect whatever you want to connect, isn't that better just go to frequency drive? Hitachi make the LY100 and over, one phase, two phases, three phases, whatever you want, which actually has the circuitry enabling you to regulate the frequency. And by that, you can trim not only voltage, but also the frequency for the device. Now, the price-wise, the smallest one starts with 22 euro, talking about 50 bucks. The typical price for the one that I researched probably 2 weeks ago was 120 bucks. Now, if you want to have something that gives you a kilowatt of power, then we're talking about $220 spent. Question is that worth the effort? And to action.
Comment and to NNU.
NNU recognized. Wesley, your audio is quite high. I think you should set the volume control on your transmitter a little bit lower, or back off of the microphone a little bit, right at the point where it doesn't quite distort, but almost distorts coming through the repeater. You didn't give the circuit you're describing a name. Was that a cycloconverter? You were saying that you can adjust the voltage and you can adjust the frequency on this circuit, but I missed the name of the circuit. And I think you're saying it's popular in Europe. I wonder if you've seen this circuit, which right now I don't know the name of. Have you seen it in the United States? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Hey, November to X-ray, Juliet, November. I think right now it should be better. The device is being called Frequency Drive. Again, Frequency Drive. What it does is, you start with 110 volts, and you can have 220. You can have it one phase, you have it three phase. It starts with a price from 22 euro, talking about 50 bucks. And it is to be obtained in United States. It is as small as your palm of your hand. And when you need to have something that is as big as 1 kilowatt, you probably will spend $220. Not even. I've researched one that gives you 10 amps at output, and it was $120. Hitachi makes one. The model number that you can start from, there are many model numbers, starts from L100, Lima 1000. Back to you, Antoine.
Very fine. Very fine, Wesley. You called it a frequency trife or something like that. Can you give me the second syllable, frequency, and the second word, blank? Can you spell that word for me? Because I'm missing something on that one. Maybe it's my accent. Over to you, Wesley.
Trafo.
frequency drive. Like, don't drive me back crazy. Frequency drive. Back to you.
Now I've got it. Very well done. Okay, that sounds like a nice thing to go. Hitachi L100 is the starting number. Alex had some words he wanted to add to this. N2NNU. Wait for the beep. You know what that means. K2RIW.
Yeah, I think what... the beep came now. I'm listening on the other repeater, so that's why I'm getting confused at times. Good evening, everybody. Sorry for the delay. I think what Wesley is talking about is a magneto-resonance transformer. It's usually used in trams, like a tramway, to regulate the speed of the machine, usually in Europe, and I think the tram, the cable tram in California uses similar stuff. But what I wanted to say is that for a period of time I was consulting for Philips Consumers, and one of the tasks that I had to design was the power supply for a reel-to-reel tape machine. From that time I learned that because of the power supply, power network in Europe is widely so unstable, it can go from 220 down to 200 and down to up to 230 without any reason. The designers of the power supply put in into the designer of the transformer quite a leeway. So it's not a transformer that I would worry about for the 0.5% change. What is it, from 230 to 240? It's 0.5%, right? What I would worry is the input EMI filters that have those capacitors in there, and they might be old and they might not take the extra voltage. That's what I would worry about it. Antoine, back to you, Dick.
K-E-Y.
Mel recognized. Yeah, 240 versus 230 is 4.3% higher than specified, which doesn't strike me as a real big problem. And so what Alex is telling us is that the voltage normally varies quite a bit in Europe, so quite possibly the manufacturer has already taken that into account. Wait for a few of those tones, and then go ahead and talk, Mel, K2KE. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very interesting application of this circuit that varies both voltage and frequency, Dick. And where did I see it? In the room air conditioners, the new room air conditioners that have come out in the last year or so, just 2 years. They vary the speed of the compressor. In other words, by the temperature, to get the additional EER of the room air conditioners, where they used to have just high and low, you know, on the air conditioner, which was basically just the fan speed. They actually now control the speed of the compressor. I was amazed because there was one that failed. I wanted to see, what the heck is this box that's connected to the compressor? And it is a speed control for the compressor, according to the information from the manufacturer, and it controls both frequency and the speed, and that's basically that's what it is. It's amazing, and that's how they pick up the additional efficiency. So they have them on the 110 machine, and they have them on the 220 machine. That the temperature controls the speed of the compressor. I was quite amazed, and that's basically the circuit he's talking about. Over.
Comment.
Yeah, it sounds similar to a circuit that I've heard called a cycloconverter. Wesley wants to make another comment. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, and to XGN. Disagree with the statement of Alex, although I very much respect the man knowledge. That's what he was talking about, was the early version of that device. Actually, what it is, it's a solid device, solid state device that is actually convert first the AC to DC, and then, and it's using the rectifier bridge. Now, another element of that is that that sinusoidal power that is switching the circuit is then, how to say, conditioned by the second electronic circuitry that is a conditioner, and then it comes with very much stable frequency and the voltage on it.
Repeater, timeout.
Very fine, Alex. I mean, Wesley. I call it a cycloconverter, but what Wesley is explaining, just to repeat it again, is that this circuit frequency drive is what Wesley called it, is a circuit which takes 110 volt AC, rectifies it to DC, then that goes into an inverter-like circuit, and the output of that inverter, you can control its voltage and its frequency, and it also contains a power conditioner, some of the better ones. And when you build an inverter to convert DC back into AC, the very early simple ones would convert it back into AC as a pure square wave. The more modern day circuits make it a stepped square wave, which comes much closer to producing a sine wave. To really produce an absolutely pure sine wave, and a DC to AC inverter is a somewhat difficult problem without getting into a whole lot of iron and resonance or a whole lot of
repeater timeout.
Or without getting into a whole lot of very fine steps with some kind of a digital counter-like circuit. So that's another way to go. I call it a cycloconverter. Wesley called it a frequency drive, but Hitachi L100 is one of the things you can look at. So looks like you got a number of solutions there, Gabe. Turn it back to you for a final, and then we're going to go on to the next person. KB2MAR. Wait for a little bit for the beep. K2RIW.
Right, can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead with your question, Mel.
On the list for an announcement.
Well, I thought, you know, in other words, we're looking at something like a switching power supply in some effect, Dick, where DC comes in, and then it is an oscillator that brings it back to a voltage, in this case, bring it back up to the required. You can call that like a switching power supply over, application over.
Yes, you could call it a switching power supply. You could call it a DC to AC inverter. You can give it a lot of different names, but you've got the right idea. It is a kind of an oscillator. But to make it very efficient, the old ones used to be a pure square wave, and some chunks of electronics are unhappy with a square wave when they were designed for a sine wave. So most of the uninterruptible power supplies we buy these days are really a stepped square wave, where there is a more brief, higher square wave built into the middle of the regular square wave. So when you look at it on an oscilloscope, it's got about three steps to each half of the sine wave. And it is a simulated sine wave, and most chunks of electronics are happy with that. I think it was Wesley who said he wanted to make an announcement. Go right ahead, Wesley.
No, it was me, Alex.
You got it, Alex.
Bye, JC. I said, I thought perhaps you put me on a list when my turn comes to make an announcement. That's all, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, you're on the list right after Wesley. Wesley is the next person on our list, N2XJN, who signed in with a question. You've got it, Wesley.
Okay, one thing before I start. Dick, is my modulation right now okay?
Just about exactly right. You've cut it down quite a bit, and it sounds real good. Relatively high fidelity. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, November 2 X-ray, Juliet, November. The first set of questions is amplifiers. Well, people have automatic amplifiers right now, and a bunch of money to spend for it. And some of them decided that they want to go for the old-fashioned one because it's less expensive, and sometimes they may just get something that seems to be kind of junky, but not necessarily is going to be junk. So they want to make something of it. And a very simple question. The amplifiers use the tubes. How many gates has the triode? That's the first question. The second question is, what is the most common voltage to make the lamp glow? And there is another set of questions. Let me shut for a moment. Okay. At first, there is a sentence. I am not going to walk 80 feet through 18 inches of snow in the middle of the night to find out if the plate tank heat resonance. And the question is, we have from the old times two very strange looking cylinders. One is being named directional coupler and the other one is Johnson, because mostly Johnson made it at first, SWR bridge. The question to that is, at first, what the new automatic antenna tuner with the amplifier has to do with that, these two devices? And the second question is, what is the difference between these two devices? And the third of the question is, what SWR bridge?
Repeater, timeout.
Alrighty. I'm pretty sure you're asking questions about an amplifier plus automatic antenna tuner. And I think you're asking, how does the automatic antenna tuner know which way to go? In other words, if I had a ordinary old-fashioned transmitter, be it a Collins or a DX100 Heathkit or whatever, where you used to have high output tuning network, where you had C1, we called it the tuning capacitor, and you had C2, we called it the loading control, and you, the ham radio operator, would adjust the tuning control and the loading control so that you simultaneously hit resonance. Resonance usually means that you were tuning the first capacitor for the minimum amount of plate current that usually represented resonance, and you adjusted the tuning
repeater timeout.
You would then adjust the loading control until you brought the current at minimum up to the specification. If the manufacturer told you that at full power output your amplifier is supposed to draw 150 milliamps, you would choose a particular setting for the loading control, rock the tuning control back and forth until you hit minimum, which usually represents resonance, and if the minimum was 150 milliamperes of plate current, you know you had properly tuned the PI output tuning network. Well, depending on the state of the exact amount of neutralization of the final circuit, you may not be adjusting for maximum power output on a bird wattmeter when you're at the exact minimum of plate current on the so-called tuning control. So you would rock that control a little bit away from the minimum until the power output maximized on your bird wattmeter.
Repeater, timeout.
And after doing some testing of the linearity of your amplifier, you may or may not find out that that particular set of settings is ideal for that particular amplifier. Along comes an automatic antenna tuner, and you and I know that when you're taking a brand new ham radio operator and you're trying to teach him to go through the procedure of properly aligning his final amplifier stage, and you're trying to teach him how to set the tuning and loading control for the drive circuit, if there is one, and to how to set the, let me drop for a second. And how to set the tuning and loading control for the final amplifier stage, that the total training procedure required to properly set up the drive, to properly set up the PI tank circuit, so that the amplifier is running at its specified power output, giving you the specified linearity, not overheating the tube, not artificially aging the tube. The total procedure for learning to teach somebody new to ham radio is kind of extensive, and he's going to make a number of mistakes until he finally finds out all the fine little nuances of properly doing that. And now, what I think Wesley is asking is, how in the world does that directional coupler and diode rectifier network, how does it do that? And the answer is that when an amplifier has its final tank circuit tuned higher or lower than resonance, there is a characteristic phase shift of the current that flows between the tube and that tank circuit. Let me drop for a second. That characteristic current, when you tune the amplifier tank circuit higher than resonance, you will get a lagging phase current reflected between the tank circuit and the final stage of the tube, the plate of the tube. When you tune it below resonance, you'll get a capacitance. So by looking at the phase shift, by looking at the phase angle of the reflected signal that is sampled with a directional coupler, with the right kind of a circuitry, it is a little bit like a blind person walking up a hill. The blind person can feel the tilt of the hill in his feet, and he knows which direction is uphill, even though he can't see the hill. By the same token, a modern-day network analyzer can easily measure amplitude and phase angle of the reflected voltage from a circuit under test. That tells it whether or not the circuit is inductive or capacitive, and how much inductive or capacitive, or how far away from 50 ohms. And once it knows the phase angle and magnitude of the reflected signal, which is usually sensed with a directional coupler, it then knows how to display the signal on the Smith chart for the cathode ray tube to tell you, the operator, what is happening. An automatic antenna tuner is a kind of poor man's network analyzer built into that automatic tuner. It knows which way to go to adjust its capacitors.
Repeater, timeout.
It knows which way to go as far as hitting the right resonance and the right amount of loading by looking at that phase shift. A directional coupler is a very simple looking circuit if you ever take one apart. Take an auto directional coupler, unscrew the cover, and look inside. You will see a straight through piece of strip line. You will see a parallel piece of strip line that is parallel for a short distance, and then one end of that parallel strip line ends in a 50 ohm load, and another one ends in an output connector. And that strip line circuit directional coupler allows you to sample the amplitude and the phase of what's going on the straight through line. If, for instance, you were using a 10 decibel directional coupler, all of the power that you sense on its sampling port would be one-tenth of the power that's flowing through the main port, the main two ports of the coupler. And if you're smart enough to measure the phase angle of that sampled voltage, it will tell you a lot about what is happening beyond the directional coupler. It'll tell you, with the right kind of intelligence, it'll tell you exactly what the nature of the load is on the directional coupler. It'll tell you if it's a resistor, or a capacitor, or an inductor, how big, how small. There's an amazing amount of information when you can measure the amplitude.
Repeater, timeout.
There's an amazing amount of information that you get when you can measure the amplitude and the phase of the reflected signal that's coming out of that sampling port of a directional coupler. I think that's part of the question you were asking, Wesley. And if not, go right ahead and give me some more questions. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Give them some insight where to find it.
Okay, let me go back to Wesley first, because there's a 50-50 chance I've misunderstood at least a portion of his question. You got it, Wesley. I'll wait a little bit for the beep.
Okay, November 2 X-ray, Juliet November. Well, the directional coupler is the PL network for the antenna analyzer meter. And I agree with you, actually, very well done job. If you could just explain the difference between SWR bridge, the old time device, and directional coupler. Back to you, Sergio.
Yeah, the old-fashioned so-called standing wave ratio bridge, really, in one, there's a whole lot of different versions, but one of the versions that I have seen is really a simple Wheatstone bridge made out of four resistors that are arranged in a diamond layout. So if I draw a square and tilt it 45 degrees so it looks like a diamond on my page, and if on each one of those straight legs I put a 50 ohm resistor, and then if from the top of the diamond to the bottom of the diamond I connect a signal generator, and from the left hand node of the diamond to the right hand node of the diamond I put a voltage sensing device, that diamond of four resistors would be perfectly balanced because the four resistors have the exact same voltage dividing characteristic of the left hand two resistors versus the right hand two resistors. No matter what I connect from top to bottom on the signal generator, the voltage sensing device from left to right would see nothing. Now if I take one of those 50 ohm resistors, remove it, and connect my unknown circuit, like my transmission line, my antenna, or anything else,
repeater, timeout,
or anything else I want to measure, I take the lower right hand resistor, for instance, the lower right hand 50 ohm resistor, I remove it and I call it the unknown port. I connect my unknown circuit there. If my unknown circuit was 50 ohms, the whole Wheatstone bridge would again be balanced and the voltage sensor would see nothing. If the unknown circuit is greater than 50 ohms, then the right-hand side will be developing a bigger voltage as a voltage divider than the left-hand side of the diamond, and the voltage sensor would see some voltage. By the same token, if the unknown circuit was less than 50 ohms, the right-hand side voltage divider would be producing less voltage than the left-hand side, and again the voltage sensor from left to right would see a voltage. But the difference is, in the first case, the voltage sensed by the voltage sensor would be in phase with what's coming out of the signal generator. That's when you got higher than 50 ohms for the unknown. If I have less than 50 ohms for the unknown, again I will develop a voltage on the voltage sensing device, but it will be out of phase. So if my voltage
net
sensing device
at 8 o'clock net tonight at 8 o'clock,
if my voltage sensing device measured not only amplitude but phase, I can tell whether or not the impedance was higher or lower than 50 ohms. That's if it's a pure resistor. And by the way, what that voltage sensing device is really measuring, after you properly calibrate it, it's measuring the S11, voltage reflection ratio, which really is the raw ingredient for calculating standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio means that there's a certain magnitude of voltage you're sending up the transmission line. If it was a 50 ohm transmission line and your antenna was a perfect 50 ohm resistor, let me drop, then no voltage would be reflected back, and my S11 would be zero. My scattering parameter called voltage reflection coefficient would be zero. If the antenna is anything but 50 ohms, higher or lower, or if it's capacitive or inductive, you're going to get a certain magnitude of voltage coming back and a certain phase angle. That tells you all the information. You can sense that with a directional coupler. You can sense it with a Wheatstone bridge of four resistors that I've just given you an example of. And there's a number of other circuits that are called in a standing wave ratio bridge. So There's a whole series of circuits. If you go to, I think it's chapter number 4 of a book called Reference Data for Radio Engineers, it's the chapter on the subject of bridge networks, and you'll find out there's about 10 different ways of setting up a bridge detecting circuit, which can measure the quality and characteristic of your unknown load, like your antenna, or anything else you want to measure. And a variation of those bridges is really what's inside of a network analyzer. A properly calibrated, let me drop. A properly calibrated network analyzer, when you connect an unknown circuit across its terminals, will tell you almost everything you want to know about that circuit. It's really measuring voltage reflection coefficient and properly displaying it as either a polar chart, which you and I call a Smith chart, or as a rectangular chart, an XY chart, where the horizontal axis is frequency and the voltage and the vertical axis is either reflection coefficient in decibels or reflectance coefficient as a ratio, which means it's plotting standing wave ratio. Turns out that these bridge detecting networks are what's really the heart of a network analyzer. And that's an extremely modern piece of equipment. In the old days, an engineer used to go to the stock room and get a signal generator, get a crystal detector, an oscilloscope. You would be assembling pieces of equipment in order to do a radio test. And somebody came along and said, why in the world do we have all of these separate instruments on that bench time and time again? Why not put everything in one box? The signal generator, the signal sensor, the phase detector, the amplitude calibrator, whatever. Put it all in one box. And that's called a network analyzer. And I was there when those circuits were first being invented. So the
repeater, timeout.
Those circuits were being invented approximately 1968 is when Hewlett-Packard started coming out with a whole bunch of technical notes on modern measurement techniques and how to make things go faster. And that signal generator that's now in a network analyzer is a sweeping signal generator. Therefore, you get a swept curve on your Smith chart or on your XY plot of what your circuit is doing at every one of those frequencies between your... You tell it what frequency to start at, what frequency to stop at, and it tells you whatever is going on in between. And to a smart person, that gives you a lot of information about where you are and where you want to go. Mel wanted to make a comment on all this. K2KEY, wait for the beep. The series of beeps, K2RIW.
To an end with another comment.
And Alex is on the list right after Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Okay, if Wesley would like to see or to really understand how a automatic antenna tuner works, I built one, a homebrew kilowatt antenna tuner that was featured in May 2002 of QST. It was a two-part feature, one on mechanically how to put it together, another part was on the theory of how it works. And this is a more modern version of what you were talking about, application of the Stone Bridge. However, if you want to look at how Collins did it years ago, how they tuned their linear amplifier with a type of Wheatstone bridge, a balance with a Wheatstone bridge, you actually detected a null. You look at the characteristic Wheatstone bridge of yesterday. They used to have nice ones in those beautiful boxes, if you remember, Dick, with Bakelite panels and a place to plug in headphones. And you would use it for, you know, precisely measuring a resistor or a capacitor or whatever. Well, they did a similar idea like that for tuning the amplifier called the Collins 30L1 amplifier. That linear amplifier, in fact, they added in this month's QST a modification to the old amplifier that's 50 years old, still going strong. But if you look at